Okay, welcome back. A lot of things going on here today, as always, in many different areas. The coronavirus stories continue to roll in. They're not all that different. There are a number of vaccine stories, but here's one. Coronavirus in, I gotta open this up here. Let me read this. A little paranoid sounding, but what the heck? The discovery of coronavirus in the bathroom of an unoccupied apartment in Guangzhou, China, suggests the airborne pathogen may have wafted upward through drain pipes, an echo of a large SARS outbreak in Hong Kong 17 years ago, which I think many of you will listen. So the idea of plumbing and high-rise buildings is still a bit of a problem area. Now that was kind of unusual to see pop up again. Let me find this other thing here. There's a lot of news in, coming out of Russia today. Three more coronavirus vaccines are being registered in Russia. Russian hospitals said all ready for a new coronavirus second wave, if there is one coming. Antibodies found in all inoculated with full course of the new coronavirus vax at the Vector Center in Russia. Putin about his daughter taking the, she took part in the trials. She took the vaccine. He said, she's an adult. She simply told me she was going to participate. And she did. And by the way, Putin's approval rating is now soaring in Russia over his handling of the coronavirus, and the lockdowns are being lifted all over the country now. So there's just a few from the other side of the world. There's a lot going on here. Tremendous amount of confusion about all these vaccines now. Henry, there must be 8 or 10 of them being talked about or worked on in various laboratories and clinics and so forth. How many vaccines are too many? Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back. The vaccines aren't all created equal, so you don't need one good one. Unfortunately, I don't think you're going to know which one is the good one until sometime next year.
See, I was going to ask you. Which is the best one, Henry? How the hell do we know?
Well, they haven't done the trials yet.
That's right.
That's what the trials are for. And Russia hasn't done the trials yet. The whole testing procedure rests largely on the phase three trials. The phase three trial takes the data from the phase one two trial. Sometimes they merge these, but essentially the initial trial is done on a limited number of patients. And Russia said that they approved their drug using 100 patients, which is just phase one. And they said they approved it, but they're doing the phase three, and but they've approved it before they've even got the results. And
what do you think? What do you think of that?
It's just stupid. They have no idea because they haven't done the testing. They don't do tens of thousands of people in a phase three trial if a phase three isn't necessary. That's where all the money is spent. They have to recruit all those people. They have to vaccinate them, and then they have to follow them, and then they have to see how well the vaccine works on a larger trial, because they're going to, if they have the vaccine, it's going to be applied to a much larger population than is in the phase one. And in fact, it'll be a much larger population that's in phase three. And they basically monitor it after it's approved and distributed, because then it goes into an even larger number of people. But the spread to the even larger number of people is based upon how well it performs in phase three, because they have a a larger group so that they can see if there's differences in age groups, you know, and they can have significant numbers in the different age groups. They can see if there's differences in different populations. Some populations seem to not do as well. They're probably due in part because of underlying conditions, so that they basically get a much better representation in the phase three. And all of these trials are just starting the phase three, as in they're getting recruits. Putin's daughter didn't participate in a phase three trial. She participated in a phase one trial.
Right.
They've only tested 100 people. That's the only trial they've done. Is a phase one, and that's just to see if there's
phase
any,
three could last. It could last a year, right? Could last a long time. Depends on how it's structured, I guess. But it's not a couple week process.
The way the phase threes are set up is first they have to recruit the people, and they start, you know, giving the vaccine before they've got everybody recruited. You know, so the initial people that they recruit, they vaccinate them. And in the case of the two that are furthest along that went into phase three first, both of those require two injections. So just to vaccinate, it takes, you know, it's about 6 weeks after the first injection before the subject is even vaccinated. Before they have a full immune response, because there's a 28-day gap between the first and the second one, and then takes a couple of weeks for the vaccine to become effective for the immune response to build. So they don't really even have the person vaccinated until 6 weeks after they start. And so after they get vaccinated, they can look and see whether they've got antibodies, and they can look and see whether those are neutralizing antibodies, and they can look and see what the titer of the antibodies are. But they're not going to know they're protective until they've been infected, and or at least been exposed to infection, and then see if there's a difference between how well the population that got the vaccine did versus the population that didn't get the vaccine. So that's how they determine whether it was effective. And how long it takes for them to get exposed and to have a comparable group to basically develop the disease kind of depends on the prevalence of the disease. And then they have to have numbers in each of these groups before they can say that it's working. And they typically, these phase three trials have like 30,000 people. So it takes a while to get that many people registered and vaccinated, and then to see how many of them actually get the disease and see what that frequency is. And it's not a challenge trial where they deliberately infect the patients with the virus. There's talk of doing that, but it's still not, there's ethical issues with that. Usually if you do a challenge trial, it's on an infectious agent that you've already got a way to treat it. It's not like
nice,
you go
and
say, well, the vaccine didn't work, so I'm sorry. We tried it and it didn't work, and we gave you the virus, and you got the disease, and X number died, and X number had this, and Y. So they typically, if they're going to do a challenge study, they have kind of a fallback position, whereas if the vaccine doesn't work, they can still avoid damage to the to the patient that volunteered to be in the trial. So it's not clear that any of these are going to do a challenge. There's going to be a challenge trial because there's really no treatment, and they can't guarantee that the vaccine's going to work. They do have volunteers, but it's not clear that they're going to go through with it because of those issues. And so if they don't do the challenge, they have to wait for the patients to get infected naturally, or at least get exposed and potentially not get infected.
They could just go to one of those coronavirus parties, couldn't they? And get
if they're going to do that, then you know they could just do a challenge if they're going to deliberately expose people to the virus. The advantage of the challenge is they control the dosage. I mean, that can be a disadvantage of the virus, the challenge also, because, naturally there's going to be a whole range of, doses that you might get exposed to. And so you might pick a challenge dose that's either too high or too low, that it's high, and so that the vaccine doesn't work on a lot of the patients, and as it turns out, naturally, you don't normally get exposed to that much virus. So the vaccine might work in the field, but it might not work in the challenge. And then if you do it the other way around and you give a low dose for the challenge, then it may work for the low dose, but most of the people that get sick end up with the high dose. And, even though it works in the challenge, it doesn't really work in the field. And you don't have any better data than you do to say whether they made antibodies or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's a question.
What would it take for you to decide to get one of these new vaccines? How much they're going to have to go through all three phases? At what point would you feel comfortable with taking one of these vaccines? Just hypothetically.
Well, I would be comfortable after they had phase three data and they can see how effective it was, and they can see whether they had this enhancement. For this particular virus, the biggest concern right now is antibody enhancement. In an antibody enhancement, you end up having an immune response that doesn't cross-react well to another version of the virus. So in this case, the early vaccines are made against the original Wuhan strain. And so if the Wuhan vaccine doesn't work that well against the Italian strain, for instance, then it's possible that the antibodies you generate against the Wuhan isn't going to protect you that well, because the Wuhan, the original strain, has already been outcompeted. So it's very rare now. So the chance of you getting infected with the original strain today is very low. Virtually all the infections in the U.S. are now due to the Italian lineage, and there's kind of three different versions of that, but they all have the same one change in the spike protein. They're part of the definition of the Italian lineage.
All right.
So
all
there's a possibility that if you get the vaccine that's going to be ready first, the first one out of the box, the first couple out of the box, they're actually doing this.
Then out of the syringe.
Out of the syringe. You'll make antibodies to that, and that'll be protective against the original virus, but it may lead to enhancement of the Italian version.
See?
And so it may make you more susceptible. And there are examples of that with MERS. MERS did give that type of enhancement effect. That's part of the reason there's no MERS vaccine right now. Right. And that is a concern. Now, the initial data they had with these vaccines didn't seem to show it, but the virus is always evolving. And the concern is that whatever they looked at initially didn't really get beyond the original versus the original type of a thing. They didn't really have that much concentration on the Italian lineage, because the Italian lineage, you know, took a couple months before it started to, you know, become more widespread. I mean, it started in February and kind of got going in March. And these trials, they started them in January. They started them very, very quickly, because in many instances, they were already working on a vaccine against the coronavirus, and they already had the package, the delivery system. They just had to go ahead and stick in the most of these, it were the spike protein. They just had to put the spike protein in the package, and then that's what they were that's what they would use in the trial. But the spike protein they put in the package was the original one. You know, because they wanted to get going on it, so they wanted to get the sequence was available in early January. So in early January, they knew what they wanted to do. They knew how to make the vaccine they wanted to make. They would have their delivery system. They would take the spike sequence from the Wuhan strain, and that's what they would insert into their package. So they would make the vaccine against the Wuhan strain, and they weren't going to switch. Because they had already started the trial. So they would want to see how that worked in the phase one, and then expand that to the phase two, phase three. So that's kind of, the key is, that, if they do the vaccination at a much larger number of individuals, they're going to get exposed to the Italian version. And so if in the field they end up not getting, you know, they get a much lower level of infection, or they have a much higher frequency of asymptomatic / mild cases, and so they can demonstrate the efficacy in a large population with the virus that's currently circulating, then I would take the vaccine. I mean, the vaccine, you know, theoretically, it's going to work. You're going to make antibodies against the virus to give you protection, but you're not going to risk, you know, getting infected with the virus and not get it under control and have all kinds of the complications that can happen with a natural infection. If you have antibodies and they're not the enhancing type of antibodies, then the chances are that you'll have no infection, or you'll have a milder disease, at least in the near term. It's not going to guarantee that the virus isn't going to mutate away from the vaccine, and that you'll have the Italian version plus three or four additional changes, which are already circulating. That's what happened patient from Hong Kong that got infected in Spain. He got infected with the Italian version that had actually picked up a couple additional changes. And the earlier infection he had from the V-clade, which is the one that was in the Middle East, didn't offer enough protection to keep him from getting infected a second time. And he got infected, you know, relatively quickly after the first one. I mean, it was about 5 months, but it was, you know, it would be good if the vaccine at a minimum would last a year, so that you could get kind of a booster every year, like happens with the flu, as opposed to only lasting a matter of months. because the level of the SARS-CoV is so high that there hasn't really been a clear-cut seasonal difference. That the virus did very well, especially in the U.S., over the summer, and it didn't really go down that much. And it went down if you were taking, you know, the measures to avoid infection. So you were wearing a mask and you were social distancing and you were reducing your likelihood of exposure. And then you could get things to go down. But, you know, as happened in the U.S., it didn't go down very far. And then it popped right back up again. And there wasn't good mask uses in some areas. And that's what led to the high levels. That's the reason the U.S. is number one in the world. There's more deaths and there's more cases than anywhere in the world. And that's because the original outbreak was very poorly managed and there was way too much resistance to do anything about it other than, you know, just do behaviors that led to an increased likelihood. It's early on the vaccine front. One of my concerns was that Trump was going to go ahead and push it and try to start using the vaccine without the phase 3 results. And he kind of hinted at that. Lately, it seems like they're kind of leaning away from that because they're talking about having a vaccine by the end of the year. By the end of the year, they should have some phase 3 results as opposed to some talk about having a vaccine next month. They have a vaccine next month. It won't be based on any data. That anything they do next month
will be like
what Russia did. It'll be like what Russia did. Russia said, oh, the vaccine works based on phase 1. They didn't say they weren't going to do a phase 3, but they did say that they're going to start licensing it out before they've got the phase 3 results. I mean, the U.S. did something like that. In the sense that they, you know, this warp speed is that they're making the vaccine now, even though they don't know that it's going to give good phase 3 data. And so they're making several vaccines in quantity, and the government is basically underwriting that. So that they're essentially saying, we'll buy the vaccine if you make it, regardless of whether it passes phase 3. So they're taking the economic risk out of it because most companies would wait to make sure that it's approved before they go and they spend a lot of money making a lot of vaccine that would be useless if it didn't get through. So if the government is going to buy it regardless, then they can go ahead and make it, and that would save time. And speaking of saving time, it's worth, you know, Trump's press secretary recently made some remarks regarding how poorly the swine flu vaccine effort went. And she said that, you know, the two main problems with that was that they stopped testing early and the vaccine came late. And, you know, that sounds pretty bad, but it really wasn't either. They stopped testing with the specific vaccine because it wasn't necessary to get the answer. And they had the vaccine ready in like late November on a somewhat similar time frame, actually a later time frame. I mean, as it turned out, for SARS-CoV, the sequence was made public, I think January 11th or something. So it was in early January. They knew that there was a problem, and they had the sequence. And that's all you really needed to make the vaccine. If you had the sequence, you could start making the vaccine. So you could start making the vaccine against SARS-CoV-2 in January. And that's what the companies that are out front in the vaccine rates did.
Right.
And swine flu. Now I want to go through this so you have an idea what is reality as opposed to what is being spun. For swine flu, nobody knew the virus existed in January of 2009. It was identified in March. Mm-hmm. It was identified in two children in Southern California. Now, as soon as those two sequences matched, there was a strong hint that there was a major problem because those two cases were in adjacent counties. They had no known contact with swine, and they had no known contact with each other. But they had viruses that had essentially the identical sequence. So because they had the same virus and they weren't connected to each other, that indicated that virus had already spread. And it was in other contexts of these two children. And so there were probably a fair number of people that had it. And then it was identified in Mexico, and it's identified in Canada, and it's identified in students returning from spring break, who would in many cases had gone to Mexico. And so it was clear that the virus was transmitting, and they needed a vaccine. And they had one advantage in the sense that it was flu, and to make a flu vaccine, you typically have this Puerto Rican strain that was isolated back in like 1939 or something. And the flu vaccines take the H and the N that you want to make the vaccine against, and they put it on the background of the other 16 from this virus that was isolated in Puerto Rico in 1939, I think. That's essentially, you know, kind of the same thing I just described. You have the new gene and you plug it into the old system. Now, in the case of flu, the old system had been around a while, but you still had to go and find out whether it was safe. So you still had to do some initial trials. You had to get the H and the N on the background, and then B, you had to start a phase 1 trial and then, you know, go up to a phase 3 trial. So you had to do the same type of trial. And, you know, Trump keeps talking about, oh, they're going to have this vaccine in record speed. Well, the vaccine that they said was available late was available in like November. It didn't have that much quantity. There was more quantity of the vaccine in like December and January, but it was available in November. So they really didn't have a sequence until late March, early April, and they got a vaccine by November of the same year. And in the case of SARS-CoV, they had like a 2-month lead because they had the sequence at the beginning of this year. And so to do it in the same time frame, you would have to have the vaccine available now. And so the swine flu vaccine was made more quickly than the SARS is going to be made. And you know, that's understandable from the standpoint that there still is no SARS vaccine. You know, a vaccine was never made against the original SARS-1 from 2002, 2003. And there hasn't been a successful vaccine made against MERS. You know, there's been work done on it, but they haven't been successful in part because of the enhanced antibodies. And so the timing of the swine flu was already going to be quicker than the time frame for SARS-CoV. So basically to say that it took too long and it wasn't available when the virus took off, well, the virus wasn't discovered until the springtime of that year. So it took less than a year. It took about 6 months to get the vaccine. And since it's, you know, a new serotype, or at least it was a swine version, it wasn't the seasonal version, it was a new virus, and you had to, you know, do some trials to make sure it was going to work, because this actually is a virus that was isolated, well, it was isolated from humans, but it originated in swine. And it was a unique constellation, so it wasn't like they had already seen this, they already seen how the virus behaves, they had already started making a pandemic vaccine just in case. This virus was brand new, and there had been somewhat similar viruses found in swine in the U.S., but this one had a combination. Some of the genes were Asia-related, and some of the genes were North American-related, and it was a triple reassortment. So some came from avian, some came from swine, and some came from humans. So in any event, the timing was actually quicker than the current vaccine. And then the other complaint that the press secretary had was that they stopped testing. But the reason they stopped testing was because the specific assay wasn't really necessary by fall. It initially, the virus showed up in March, which is towards the end of the flu season. And there was still seasonal H1N1 and still seasonal H3N2 circulating. So you did need a specific assay. And the same thing was done, that initially was done by the CDC, and then the national labs like Quest stepped in, and then Quest started offering the test. I actually was confirmed with a sample that was confirmed by Quest, and they shipped it out, and then, you know, the virus spread fairly quickly, so they looked to bump it up, and so university labs started developing their own assays, and they started developing an assay here in Pittsburgh at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and they had an in-house assay. And as it turned out, over the summer, the seasonal flu, the H1N1 seasonal and the H3N2 seasonal faded, because they typically fade in the summer. I mean, that's why they call it seasonal. It starts in the fall and goes over the winter and starts to fade in the spring. But it not only faded, the swine flu became so dominant that at the beginning of the fall season, that was the only virus that was circulating, the only influenza A that was circulating. It totally outcompeted seasonal H1N1 and seasonal H3N2. So by the fall, you didn't need the swine-specific test. All you really had to do was see whether the patient was influenza A positive. If they were influenza A positive, that meant they had swine flu, because that was the only influenza A flu that was circulating. The other two had totally disappeared by the fall. And so you didn't need this more exotic, specific type of test that would identify swine flu and would be negative against seasonal flu. All you really had to do is the initial broadcast, which is widely available, which is a simple test to see whether you had influenza A. And at Pittsburgh, I mean, I was very familiar with what happened. They did get their test set up, and they were getting samples in. And they were getting so many positives that they ended up telling the doctors that, you know, if you've got a patient and they've got influenza symptoms, our positive rate is so high that there's really no need to wait, you know, to send the sample in and wait for the results. You should just assume they have swine flu, and in the vast majority of cases, you're going to be right. So the positive rate got so high that they didn't even need to do the influenza A test. That's all that was circulating by the fall. And if you had the flu-like symptoms, you ended up having swine flu. So, and then, as it turned out, the older population, which is the population that is generally most susceptible to having serious problems, hospitalizations, and death from influenza, really had immunity to swine flu, because even though in general they had not had swine flu prior to 2009, they had grown up when H1N1 was really the only influenza A that was affecting humans. And so if they had flu as a child, they had H1N1. And it turned out they had some cross-reactivity between seasonal H1N1 and swine H1N1. And therefore, they really didn't get that sick from the virus. And the population that was most susceptible to swine flu were younger adults, you know, adults that were 20, 30 years old, because they had, when they grew up, they were exposed to H3N2, which appeared in 1968. And so they had good immunity to H3N2, but they didn't have good immunity to H1N1. And so they were more susceptible to the swine. And it, as it turned out, because the swine outcompeted seasonal, the number of deaths from flu wasn't that high. There were like 17,000 or so, which is an average flu season. And so overall, it wasn't that high because, A, the elderly, who were usually the largest population that accounts for the deaths, had immunity, and they really didn't get that sick from this.
Okay, here we are. When you hear that little beep beep, that means we've lost our guest. And usually they're on a cell phone, and it hits their chin, and it interrupts the, it hits the off button, or whatever button is down there. Anyway, we'll get him back. He really ought to be lecturing at a major university somewhere. He's quite knowledgeable, gets a little bit academic, which we are at that point in this whole pandemic now, the academic point. Henry, you're back.
Yeah, I'm back. So anyway, I was just finishing up and saying that's why the swine flu really wasn't that bad, that essentially there was no seasonal flu. The total number of deaths was something like 17,000, which is actually on the low side for flu season. And the big difference was that those that were dying were younger, and the older patients that normally make up the deaths for seasonal influenza didn't die, because the other two, the H3N2, which is what usually kills them, was not circulating, and the H1N1 swine flu, they did better.
Okay.
So there was a plan. The plan did work. The vaccine was made in record time, and the testing wasn't necessary because the virus had essentially eliminated seasonal flu. Now, the situation is exactly the opposite today, because you got SARS-CoV, there is no vaccine, and it does kill a higher percentage of the population, and probably mostly because of the polybasic plebiscite, it causes a whole array of different types of illnesses. And so it's a problem, even if you don't die. And there's a lot of concern about getting the virus, and there's a lot of concern about them. It's sweeping mm-hmm. through schools. So that's why when the CDC changed their recommendation a few days ago and basically said, well, you don't really need to get tested if you're asymptomatic, it didn't go over well at all. There was a lot of resistance to that. Various governors said that they were just going to disregard those CDC recommendations because they were trying to control the virus, and they know the virus can spread by asymptomatic. They know that the virus can spread in schools by asymptomatic. So the idea that if you've got contacts of people of known cases, the idea that you wouldn't test them to get the virus under control was crazy. And so they did kind of walk that back today, and they said, well, you know, it's just a recommendation, and we know that asymptomatic can spread. And so if you're concerned, if you're trying to control the spread, then yeah, you should test the asymptomatic cases. And so the damage has already been done. The essentially between this recommendation, and actually part of the reason they were able to get a consensus on this new recommendation is Tony Fauci was in the hospital and was under anesthesia, so he wasn't available to give a whole lot
excuses,
of input,
Tony.
Or voting.
No excuses. Come on.
And they kind of got this through, and then he said he wasn't really that comfortable with it, so he wasn't giving it his endorsement. The clinical and academic community was not giving it any endorsement. And this was largely pushed through with Scott Atlas thought it was a great idea. And Redfield,
Atlas.
I think, is the one who came up with
it. We got a question here, Professor.
Okay.
A couple of them. People are going to be now... I'm getting a feedback here, Todd. Maybe we've got something open there. I don't know. People are beginning to be pounded with, get your flu virus shot. Yeah, get your flu vax.
Right.
Stop that flu virus. Stop any one of four
right.
of them. Is there anything you can offer people by way of caution or common sense in terms of a pandemic atmosphere and loading up your body with a quadrivalent flu vaccine? Should people do it if they are in the obese class or the compromised immune system class of Americans? If you're overweight, should you get a flu vax?
Yeah, you don't get the flu from the flu vax.
Understood. That's not what I said.
And the reason that is being advertised now is the time to get the vaccination because the flu season hasn't started. So the chance that you would get the virus at the same time that you take the vaccine or shortly after you take the vaccine is very low. The virus isn't circulating now. So now is the time to get the vaccine. When you get into flu season, then you could make a stronger argument that, well, you're going to take the vaccine, and while you're making antibodies to the vaccine, all of a sudden you get a live virus, and that's going to get in the way of mounting a strong response against that virus, because you're working on these four different viruses that are in the vaccine, and and that would make it difficult, more difficult to concentrate on the one virus that is actually alive, and it could cause the complications. So the whole idea of a flu vaccine is not to wait until there's the flu season and not to just figure, well, you don't need it, because people, if they have these underlying conditions, they're more susceptible to the complications of the live vaccine, not from the, I'm sorry, the live virus, not the vaccine. And that's why they're, and the other reason they're recommending that is because there's that if it's a bad flu season, or if a lot of people have the flu, and then a lot of people have COVID, then that's going to tax the hospitals. That they're going to have all these beds that are full of flu patients, and then they're not going to have the space to handle both the flu and the COVID cases. And that's and so the other reason is to avoid the confusion over what do you have, because the symptoms are fairly similar. So if you got those symptoms, you know, do you have the flu or do you have COVID? And you know, there's already been issues with testing for COVID and
it's
not
be harder
having
to get.
Right. Well, the biggest issue is wait time. That if you go on, if you take the test and you don't get the results for 10 days or something,
could be a couple weeks.
You know, it's not very useful, because essentially, if you need to quarantined, by the time you get the results, your quarantine period is over. So you don't really know whether you're being quarantined, you know, if you should be quarantining because you really have the virus, or if you're quarantining and you're going to end up being negative. And like I said, most of the tests are negative, even if there's a lot of virus around. I mean, if there's a 20% positive rate, that's a high rate, but that still means that 80% of the people test negative. And so if you end up testing negative, then, you know, it's not as critical to be quarantined, because you probably don't have the virus. And so the idea of getting the flu shot now is to get your immunity, so you've got immunity to the flu, and you're not going to have the complication of you've got the flu now, and if you've got underlying conditions, then you're more likely to end up in the hospital with the flu. And it's probably not where you want to be. There's a lot of COVID anyway, because if you go to the hospital with the flu, you might end up coming out of the hospital with COVID. Yeah. And so it's not a good year to get the flu. And so the best way to avoid getting the flu is to get a flu shot. Now, it's possible that the numbers will be somewhat reduced. And I had said this before, that there's some responses that are basically antiviral responses. So if there's a lot of COVID around, that may decrease the amount of flu that's around. So the flu season may not be a bad flu season, but that's still not a reason that you shouldn't take the vaccine. Because, you know, the vaccine is still going to offer you the protection. So now's the time to get the vaccine, because that is available. And it's safer to do it before the flu season starts, but not way before, because then it'll start waning. But now is not way before. I mean, you'll have good immunity.
When are you getting your flu vax?
I'm actually, well, frankly, I was worried I had COVID. So I was going to, I got tested for COVID. I wasn't going to get my flu shot until No, I was just suspecting. Anyway, I was negative today, so I'm going to get the flu shot.
Get someone to take a picture of this. I want a picture of this.
A picture of what?
Flu shot. Getting your flu shot. I want to post
it. Know.
You can wear a mask.
Okay.
Fun. Fun with flu, Henry. Remember, fun with flu. We got to have fun with this stuff. All right. Okay. Talk to you tomorrow. Thanks a lot for the update. Amazing amount of knowledge. Yes. Okay. All right.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. And there he goes. All right. Tomorrow. Is it Friday? It's Friday already. All right. Talk to you tomorrow. Be well. Stay safe. Remember, take those supplements and keep your immune system up and strong. Talk to you tomorrow.